True or false? Nigel Farage said that it was worth Brexit was worth it just for blue passports alone. True or false? Liz, what do you think?
Oh God, it sounds like something you'd say, so I'll say true. I don't know, but it sounds like it. We
Bill?
also know that it's not true, so that's probably why I think it's
I mean, just to be contrary, I could say no anyway, but I actually don't think he would say just that alone was worth it. So I don't think he would have said that.
It is true.
Really?
Liz won.
So why is he saying Brexit's a disaster when we've got blue passports? Is it because they look black?
Oh, because he's a lying.
Well,
I mean, he said the worst thing that would happen is that the economy would be better than it is today. That's what he said. It's just a grift, isn't it?
yes.
Is that on film or is that in printed media?
I think the blue passport's in printed media. The economy will be better is on camera. I think it was on the BBC. If you want to get specific. Ready for number two?
Ready for number two.
Britain has signed more trade deals than ever since Brexit. Bill.
Hang on a minute. Are we counting the ones where they basically photocopied old ones and tipexed out European Union and put United Kingdom in? Are we counting carryover deals here or genuinely new deals? If it's
We're
genuinely
carrying
new,
over. That was a trick, Bill. You're too
right.
smart. I
So I can believe that if you're just photocopying old deals and then scrubbing one word out and putting another in.
I'm just going to give you both a point for that one. Yes, it is true. Phil, you gave it away. It is the copy and paste. They literally copied and pasted. Yes, it does include that. So 2-1. Well done, Phil. Liz, Trump suggested the UK follow Trump in building a wall to keep out migrants.
Oh, well, it wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know where he's thinking he's going to build the wall. It wouldn't surprise me. I don't keep on top of Trump. I mean, I try to avoid him as best I can, actually. Him and Elon Musk, I decide not to go near them. But it wouldn't surprise me if he did say that, but I don't know where he'd build it.
Phil?
Phil's
I
not
mean, I'm
convinced.
just trying to think if he is stupid enough to think you could build a wall in the channel. I'm not sure because he know, he knows we're an island. He actually knows that. He visits sometimes. He has a golf course here, so he knows we're an island.
A friend of mine lived, who's English, lived in California for over a year, made friends, and as he was leaving his at the airport, his friends are waving goodbye, and one of them, I swear to God, shouted, "Enjoy France." Done for a year. He speaks English. He said he's from England, from Oxford, and he still thought he was French. Just
So,
like
I'm still going to say
it's possible
false.
that he thinks that we're France. It is possible.
It is also possible. I'm going to say no because I'm going to say no.
It makes
I
you
think he th I think he realizes we're an island, but I'm not 100% sure it's certain.
Well, I mean, you could be in reference to Ireland, Northern Ireland, putting a wall there.
Okay.
Gibraltar could be putting a wall there.
We
Actually, there
sort
is a
of
wall
already
there.
have done with Brexit.
Yeah, it
Spain put
worked.
it there for us.
They did very kindly.
Go on then, put us out of our misery, Al.
What was Phil's answer? He
I'm
thinks
going to
it's
say
false.
no. I've got to say no. It's a bloody island.
And Liz, you're thinking it's true.
Yeah, I mean, Trump says
He
anything
does.
to get his base
This
going,
is the
it
problem.
would
It's
get red
false.
meat. It's false.
It's false. He did not say that. But interesting again that you think that he could say that.
No, nothing was, he could say anything.
Yeah, it's so 2-2. Final round. Trump, because he's so obsessed with infrastructure projects, wants to create an immigration migration superhighway to deport people as quickly as possible. So it's a superhighway to drive cars on to get people out of the country. True or false? Final round, and Phil.
I don't think he owns a road building company, so I'm going to say false.
Liz?
It wouldn't surprise me if he said it. It wouldn't surprise me because it does, nothing is based on reality. So I'll say true because I think Trump is just full of trumping lies.
And Phil, you're saying
I'll
it's
say
false
false.
just because he doesn't own a road
Just
construction
because I don't see
company.
how he profits from it, yeah.
Because Phil
Phil.
is far too logical.
Well, Phil, congratulations. You win. You win this round, true
Oh.
or false. Well done. It is
Phil,
false.
you're
He's
more
not building a
connected to
superhighway.
Trump than me.
Well, I keep saying I get up. My regime this year in 2025 is to get up in the morning and find out what that idiot said overnight while we were sleeping.
Oh my God,
Today
I
he was
just
attacking the
avoid it.
ICC. He's like it issued economic
I've
sanctions
seen
against the
them.
ICC.
That's the first thing I read this morning, and actually I couldn't finish the end of the article because I was like, oh my God, this is terrifying me now.
What did he say about the well, let's just get into
Well,
the show. Welcome everyone to the Sunday Roast, and we have two fabulous, well, we have a co-host and a guest. Phil, can you please introduce yourself?
hi, my name's Phil. I'm from a different bias channel discussing political stuff, mostly British politics, although American politics has now crept into the arena.
I can't not do it present. And Liz, my wonderful co-host.
I am Liz Webster, and I'm the founder of Save British Bombing because we bomb, and I'm terrified of an America trade deal. And Trump terrifies me, America terrifies me. So at the moment, I'm in the zone of actually trying to avoid anything to make myself feel terrified. So Trump is my absolute massive anxiety.
You could include in that group of being terrified, you can include Panama, Greenland, Canada, the UK, Gaza. Five countries, all supposedly some form of ally, terrified of him. Hi, I'm Alex. I'm the other co-host of the Sunday Roast. I'm a historian, journalist, and YouTuber. So, what has Trump done with the ICC that you guys were saying just before this? You said that you were terrified. Can you explain to our viewers what's happened with the ICC? I'm going to throw this over to Phil.
So Trump, while we were sleeping, this is obviously going to come out a couple of days later, but he has said he's targeting the ICC, including its employees, with economic sanctions on the basis of they shouldn't be allowed to investigate people from Israel because they have they're investigating Netanyahu and Gove, is it? And in relation to crimes against humanity and war crimes, and he said they shouldn't be allowed to because neither the United States nor Israel is a signatory of the ICC, missing completely the fact that the alleged crimes took place in Palestine, and Palestine is a signature of the ICC. So just as if I went to America and committed a crime, I wouldn't be able to say, sorry, I'm not a US citizen. I don't. In fact, it reminds me of something. When in the days when I used to watch television, there was one of those police shows where they do a fly on the wall of police patrols and stuff, and there was this Danish fella peeing against a wall, and he thought he was immune from the on-the-spot fine because he was not a UK citizen, and he wasn't breaking Danish. Although I suspect he would have been breaking Danish law as well, but if it was in Denmark. But that's what, you know, that's what some people don't seem to understand. It doesn't matter that Israel is not a signature to the ICC. He has allegedly committed crimes in a country that is. But anyway, that's the justification, the fact that, oh, you know, we're not. So he is now issuing economic sanctions against people who work for the court. So he's attempting to bring down the ICC with, again, like as he's doing with everything, the economic might of America, which in the long run, I think everything he's doing is going to weaken America's economic might because it's going to force countries to have to, as much as they can, America-proof themselves. But the less people rely on America economically or militarily or whatever, the easier it is just to tell them to stop being stupid when they start being stupid.
It's wild, isn't it? Liz, you said off air, it's a repeat of history. Liz, what's your interpretation of these events?
Well, you know, it's very frightening because Trump and America is the world's most powerful country. And, you know, if they're intent on smashing all organizations, including the ICC, you know, and bringing them down so people don't respect them, it's very frightening because we'll turn into a complete lawless world. Goodness knows what happens. The difference is with the 1930s and, you know, 1920s, 30s was that America wasn't, you know, was a massive country and a massive weight and wasn't rogue, and it was just happening in Europe. So there were, you know, Germany and Italy got together and agreed with that, and yes, Japan, but now the thought of America doing this with the weight of the Russian insurgency. Where does China sit? Is China going to come round and stand up for the ICC? Well, I don't know. All of these things make me feel very frightened. So I think the only ones that are backing up the rules-based order are the EU.
Which is great. I mean, I said this last week. I feel like the EU is actually fulfilling its purpose. It's a bulwark against anyone else being a bit too powerful. It is a powerful group of countries when combined. And I was talking about Orban. I'm certain Orban in the 1920s, 30s would have been full dictator at this stage. He has got limitations. I'm not saying he hasn't eroded democracy, he clearly has. But people in Hungary have the ability to vote for MEPs and get the EU involved and involve the EU courts to deal with his insanity, which it can to a certain extent, as well as withholding funds, which they've been doing. So I'm thinking to myself, this is again another sign that the EU is exactly what we need right now. And it's funny, I thought this week was quite wild in the fact that, yeah, he's attacking. I didn't realize he'd actually put sanctions against the ICC.
Well, he hasn't yet. He's announced he's going to.
So do you think he'll do it? Because it seems like he keeps rolling back these things
Who
when he's
knows?
told he's an idiot.
Don't know. I have no idea when he says a thing whether he intends to follow through with it or not. He's a child. He's just a child.
And he's in power.
It's abundantly clear because what's his name? Go on, Bannon. Even in 2015, was going around that he wanted to, have a world war. Whilst they say crazy things, when they say things like that, and you look at their actions and what they do and what they've done, it's obvious that they just want to smash everything. Look what Musk has done to Twitter. When you're that wealthy, when you're more wealthy than many of the countries, one person is more wealthy than countries, we're in a very dangerous situation. And it has happened in history before. It happened with East India Company, but they were rivaled against the crown at that stage in terms of expansionism. And in many ways, we're in a similar sort of parallel to that period, and the war period as well. So I just don't know
You can make a
what is going
comparison with
to
Henry Ford. Henry Ford was one of the richest men on the planet. He had his own
happen.
newspaper, which he was selling along with all his cars. It was printing anti-Semitic stuff. So it's not that far from what Musk was doing. I mean, I still can't get over that salute and how, I mean, there's so much to take in with that. You've got the Nazi salute, and then you've got Trump going, I'm going to do ethnic cleansing. You then got members of the British government, did you see Priti Patel come out and say, oh, we shouldn't be talking about this now because we don't know what he really meant?
You talked about the government, then said Priti Patel. Just to be clear, she's no longer a member of the
Not.
government, thank goodness, and hopefully never will be.
But she's a member of parliament,
Yes.
and her then being rolled and in the opposition government. So her being rolled out and then saying what she said. I mean, we already know there's something dodgy going on with her in Israel because she got
Yes.
caught.
She was sacked, basically treating with a foreign power behind her own government.
Do you reckon they've got her in some sort of op where they've actually.
Don't know.
Because you hear
I'm
that.
less concerned about Patel these days. She's part of the old guard. The public won't really regard her anymore.
Although she did get voted back in again
Yeah,
after
but in
all
a very safe Tory seat. I mean, yes, it was possible she could have lost, but it was still traditionally a very safe Tory seat.
does make you wonder what goes through the local people's minds when they go, yeah, I'll vote that back
It's
in. Is it?
habit. If you,
Yeah.
it's like, I'm the same. If you put a red rosette on a baboon, I will vote for it because I just need it to be trained to go through the right door. And they just have the same attitude.
Logical, Phil. Why would you want to?
There's some Labour MPs annoying me at the moment. But
Do
yeah.
they?
Well, it's just being stupid. I don't mind, certain positions or whatever. I just don't like the stupidity. MPs are just incredibly stupid people.
Wow.
Don't like them.
That's and you're saying that about Labour as well, who you are
There's a
obviously.
group of Labour MPs who reported this week. They're ones in seats where they're a bit worried about Reform UK. Okay, Reform UK could take some Labour seats next time. And their response to it is they want the leadership to lean more into immigration. And it's like that's the one area you cannot beat Farage. You will never. Like, what are you going to do? You could halve immigration, and Nigel Farage says, "Well, I'm going to get down to net zero. That's the only net zero he cares about." I'm going to get down to net zero. You can't outbid him on immigration. Whereas we know from this week, Farage is rattled about their lines on the NHS because Labour are going to get waiting lists down. And Farage keeps going around talking about privatising the NHS, and that's why he stood up in Parliament in PMQs before trying to ask a completely unrelated question, saying, "Oh, yeah, we believe in healthcare free at point of access." No, you don't. You've been recorded saying otherwise. Rupert Lowe, Reform UK MP, recently said he thinks people should buy private health insurance and opt out of the NHS. It's very obvious that the Reform UK and Labour can show this with recordings. And Farage is terrified of his target voters finding out. So that's what they should hammer. They should hammer the NHS because, one, they're going to achieve noticeable improvements. I don't know where we're going to be in a few years, but it'll be noticeably better than now. And secondly, that's where Reform are vulnerable. Because for whatever reason,
well, it's not only that, Phil. The biggest thing is this America trade deal. I mean, Farage is, you know, loud and proud about his allegiance to Trump and America. Trump isn't popular in this country, but for sure, I mean, and polling time and time again shows it, roughly 9 out of 10 people don't want the America trade deal. And this is what brings me on to the farming issue, because we've still got, but he's back. Like, you know, it's like one of those horror films to me that we've got the America trade deal back there, you know, which will destroy British agriculture. And everyone goes, "Oh, but Nigel Farage turned up your tractor rally." Piers Corbyn turns up to our events. You can't stop anyone turning up to, you know, something which is in the centre of bloody London. It's just the cameras focus on Farage, and he's very, very good at getting clips out. They think, I like Labour. I've always voted Labour, so I'm going to listen to what they say. I've always voted Conservative, so I'll listen to what the Conservatives say. And then we've got some of them leeching into Farage without thinking about what he means. And that's why it's important that those of us that do keep the receipts and do see what is going on are also heard by people, because it does mean sometimes you've got to get out of your comfy armchair that you feel comfortable in and think, what is going on? This morning, Liz Kendall is in the press to talk, you know, scapegoating benefit claimants. Well, I've been a Labour supporter and voter all of my adult life. I can't believe I'm hearing a Labour minister scapegoat.
Do you agree with that sentiment?
Well, if you speak to people here today, you will know that many of them have either just lost jobs that they desperately miss or really want to get back into work once they've got their health condition under control.
Do you disagree with that sentiment?
So I think that there are many more people who want to work. I've no doubt, as there always have been, are people who shouldn't be on those benefits, who are taking the mickey. And that is not good enough. We have to end that.
You know, benefit claimants. When billions of pounds went in dodgy COVID contracts and they promised to do something about that, and they're blaming people for claiming benefits. It also helps the local economy. It doesn't go out of the country. It goes into the local economies. They buy food and, you know, everything from their household budget. It is not costing us money to give benefit claimants money. What costs us money is giving money to people who take it out of the country. And that is really what's making me furious with the Labour government right now.
So what I would say on that one, to counter that one, is I don't think they are saying that. I think what people, the press are putting certain angles on things. So Liz Kendall, for example, has said she's actually said, and like this week, we should stop blaming people on benefits. So I don't think she is blaming them. What they're trying to do is they're trying to put the emphasis on people who cheat the system. Now, there is a little bit of like a dog whistle to it, because a lot of the public just resent anything the DWP do. But they are like, there was a parallel situation, for example, with Wes Streeting. Now, I'm not his biggest fan, but there were people going, "Oh, how disgraceful he was talking about this thing in terms of like equality." So this person going on about being anti-white said, "No, that was the media." What Wes Streeting was talking about was how DEI is really important in the wake of what Trump's doing. He said, "No, it's really important." But the way the media span it, because during his talk, he happened to mention about, "Oh yeah, in some cases people aren't applying it properly. There was this guy boasting about how they were anti-white." And the media just ran with that. And so everyone gets in on it because they see the headline and they think that is the point of what they were saying. whereas they didn't actually listen to what they said, which was just like this throwaway point, which, yeah, he probably shouldn't have done because he should have realised how the media would take it.
The media ask questions and you can spin it around. You can sort of turn around and say, oh, actually, I want to talk about this. You don't have to go into that diatribe of scapegoating. And again, it does take us back to the 1930s, because just remember that, you know, that film... that was an American film, actually educating the public about not getting drawn into, you know, scapegoating people. And we've just got that going on at every single level. It's everywhere. And really, we need to think about the whole thing collectively, not from a sort of like, they've told me this, so I'm going to blame them for that. Blaming civil servants, blaming everybody. And really, we need to come together and find solutions, not focus on blame.
What's the Chinese proverb? If you blame yourself, no, if you blame others, you're nowhere. If you blame yourself, you're halfway there. If you blame no one, you've arrived. And it's pretty accurate. It's immature what they're doing. But then, you know, Phil brought it up earlier. We've got a child American president. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's just spouting stuff that he's probably heard from the guys that wrote Project 2025. And then doing stuff that he thinks either will help his construction companies or that will be popular with the public, or I think there's a third, it's about his legacy. Like, I think it was Teddy Roosevelt that bought Alaska. That's a legacy that will last through the centuries, and Trump is obsessed by that. So if he somehow managed to get America Greenland or Gaza, well, you know, that would be ethnic cleansing, or Panama, or Canada, potentially that could be such a revolutionary thing for the United States. It'll live on forever. Like, he'll be ill. You know, Christ, Canada could get renamed Trump-like in honour of him bringing Canada in.
Guy Verhofstadt saying that the EU should offer membership to Canada. At that stage, my head was just melting in half. You know, it's just incredible what is going on. It is. And I think that Starmer is looking more and more like Chamberlain every day, because he's not... actually facing up to what is going on. I mean, if that had been me, if I was Prime Minister now and I'd seen Guy Verhofstadt say that as the Prime Minister of Britain, I would turn around and say, yes, Canada and Britain need to come back to the EU. Dropping my red lines now.
Problem though, he has been realistic. He's not doing everything right, but he's been realistic. They're not his red lines. He's like the most famous Remainer in the country. They're not his red lines. They're the public's red lines. And you know, you can look at, oh, but this poll. Yeah, that's not a poll of the key target voters. We have a first-past-the-post system.
Did the public set those red lines?
They do. It's not. They were absolutely focused on who their key voters were. They spent several years finding out who are the vote. These are our target areas. These are the areas we can win. Who are the people who swing their vote in those areas? And they found out exactly who they were. And we know that because although it's easy for people to go, oh, they just won because the Tories are unpopular. We know from detailed polling that where Labour got their greatest gains was specifically those groups they'd been targeting. So it'd been very effective. So you've got two types of people that were important. There is the ones who do want us to go back to the EU. But first of all, they're worried about they've already damaged family relationships, friendships, stuff like that. So they don't want a big public debate, which is why if you look at what Labour are doing, it is going back to the EU. Everything Labour would do to go back into the EU slowly and carefully is their policy. Whether they're doing it in the right way, obviously there's some policy experts saying, no, you're not giving out the right vibes, but their aims are still the same. And then the other group of people, and those group of people, by the way, the issue of the EU is low saliency. So like you look at a poll going, this many people would like to go back to the EU, but how important is it? It's not important at all. It's just a thing. If you gave them another referendum, they'd go, yeah, I'll join. But how important is it to their voting decisions? Not at all. Then you've got another group of people who are really important in a lot of those constituencies who do not want to go back to the EU. And for them, the saliency is much higher. There, for them, it is a voting issue. And that's the political reality. And what we want to do is to have a few years where we can have better relations with the EU. Hopefully, I like the idea that Lammy is now arguing for customs union, because people keep getting hit up on the single market and it could take 10, 15 years. It might be quicker just to join the EU. But a customs union is something that could be possible going into the next election, because I don't want the same red lines going into the next election. So how do you get rid of those red lines? Because they're not internalised within Labour. How do you get rid of those red lines? You have to show people the benefits of rubbing them out. So
I guess that then says to me that the media have had a massive... I've not seen the data. I trust you on the data on that. And you're saying you've seen information from Labour that suggests that the swing voters...
Labour don't share their stuff with me, but there's plenty of other analysts do lots of detailed polling leading up to the election that pointed out the same thing.
So it's the swing voters, which then brings in first past the post being a major issue and obstacle for us going back in.
The number of people who decide a general election, it doesn't matter what the turnout is, doesn't matter how many vote, it's about 200,000 or 300,000 people. That's who determines who's in government. That is the difference between Labour getting a strong majority and the Conservatives getting a strong majority. Now, over time, because that vote is becoming more fragmented, you're going to end up in situations where we naturally have coalitions. We might as well have PR and have better coalitions. But that is the difference. It's 200,000 or 300,000 people. It's never any more than that. Well, this year or 2019 or 2017 or any other year.
So that says to me two things. Like, you brought up that there's a disconnect, essentially, between people's problems and realising it's caused by Brexit. And for whatever reason, like, cost of living is like one of the biggest issues. NHS is one of the biggest issues. And I can't remember what the third one is off the top of my head. But there are three issues. And you go, well, cost of living would be helped with Then you've got the NHS and EU doctors leaving, which had a massive impact. Yeah. Plus, you have less funding in tax because we've lost trade and we've been damaged. Then you've got this issue of immigration that still no one in the press properly deals with. I quite like the BBC4 interview with Farage, where they were like, can you just tell us what your policies are? And they couldn't. And then I think yesterday, Zia Youssef, the chair of Reform, came out and said, in the first 30 days, we're going to do all these policies that will improve everything. And then said nothing about what those policies were. It's all a smoke and mirrors thing. To me, when I'm listening to you say that, I'm seeing a disconnect with the public and them understanding that Brexit is part of the cause for the things that they're most concerned about. And obviously there's other stuff.
No one's telling them. Like, if you think about, so you think to yourself, so why at the moment is support for going back to the EU stronger than it has been since we left? You know, so surely that's people realising that Brexit's caused damage. No, it's not. It's people just realising that what they were promised hasn't arrived. People are not seeing the damage of Brexit. They're not seeing it. They're not seeing it. They know that it's now harder to get a prescription. They're not seeing that in terms of European supply chains. They, you know, all of these things they see, they're not joining it up. And you can't expect people to join it up. This is where they should be informed, but no one is informing them. This is why
I would go back to saying the red lines were stupid to even get behind them. If they put on their manifesto that they were going to withdraw the winter fuel allowance, they would have definitely not won. By just saying, yes, we're going to, you know, we're going to look after Brexit, or they could have come up with a vague thing. But to put these red lines down when most people are not wanting to look at life through Brexit, because it just feels like, oh, not Brexit again. And we had a similar thing with Iraq War. When that decision for the Iraq War was made, in fact, the public were behind it by 60-odd%. And then quickly it went away. And because they didn't go to the polls and vote for it, a lot of people said, oh, I never supported it, even though they probably did. But once it became arduous, people just wanted it to go away. And people feel like that about Brexit. There's a small minority who are really very much about protecting Brexit. But those people don't vote Labour. They vote Reform now.
But they did vote Labour. That's the point. You say most people don't want it. 65% of the people who actually showed up to vote, which was only about 60% of everyone eligible, didn't vote for Labour. Labour won a massive majority on 35% of the vote. The majority matters nothing. The majority is a red herring in a first past the post.
Well, if Labour had swung more to, you know, less Brexity, they might have got more support, because a lot of people didn't vote Labour because they were worried about the red lines.
No, we know that they've got less support. I know it's uncomfortable. It's not a nice thing, but the detailed polling shows us they would have got less support. For example, some people got behind. Even Byline Times fell for this. There was that, you may remember, there was this poll someone produced saying, oh, if Labour were more pro-EU, they'd actually win more votes in these areas. But it was complete rubbish. I looked at it myself, and it was I'd have been embarrassed if one of my GCSE students had come up with that. It was embarrassing. But others as well, other data analysts looked at it and said, this is absolutely ridiculous. I tried to find out who did it. You know who did it? A kid straight out of university after doing a history degree. It was, You look at, that was what it was. It was very hard to find out. They were being a bit coy about who it was. And it turned out it was this 26-year-old with a PhD in history. And yeah, historians can learn how to do polling, sure. But this is someone straight out of university who did it, had never worked for a polling company. And you could tell because you looked at it and the way they constructed the questions was utterly ridiculous and the conclusions were utterly spurious. But people will promote it because it says about what they want. To...
about not having definitive red lines, which have strapped them now in a really, really awkward place. Brexit... Even the Brexiteers themselves came out saying, you know, Brexit won't disrupt our place in the single market.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the issue that we've ended up in a place that Theresa May was in, which is impossible. And, you know, it's just and the risk is, and the beneficiary, as we're seeing in the polls, is Nigel Farage and Reform.
No.
Even though they want to be
able to do NHS. I don't trust those polls either.
No, it's not. The polls, it doesn't matter about the polls. You can argue about the odd point here or there. It doesn't matter. All that's happening with the polls, right, and I'll give you another little example here. All that's, and Reform UK know that the polling at the moment is not going to stay as it is. All it is, it's a reflection of the fact people have decided the Conservatives completely messed everything up. Without necessarily knowing exactly what they think they messed up, but they know they've messed up, so they're not going to go back to the Conservatives. Labour, it's all over the manifesto, change, but people go, but there's no change. And it's like, but no one's telling them, yeah, the budget hasn't even been implemented yet. None of the legislation's gone through, apart from making rail companies nationalised again. That's it. All of their first wave of legislation is still passing through Parliament. So nothing can change till later. But people don't understand that. No one's telling them that. So they're just thinking, well, we're here, whatever, 8 months later or something, 7 or 8 months later, and there's not been any change. So what are they doing? They're going, well, Conservatives didn't have the answers. Labour clearly don't have the answers because nothing's changing. So we'll go with the extreme option. But that isn't going to last. The Conservatives have lost agency, so they're struggling. But Labour have agency to turn that around for themselves. And Reform UK know that. Because think to yourself, why are Reform UK making this big fuss about some of the local elections being deferred till next year to take rather than, because otherwise they would have to have elections this year and then new elections next year anyway to take account of the changes. Why are Reform UK getting in a fuss about this? Because surely Reform UK want that, because that gives them another year to build up momentum, to build up their infrastructure, to get their activists more involved and you know, on board with things and trained up and all the rest of it. And then they could benefit next year, couldn't they? Especially with the Senate and Holyrood elections in Scotland and local elections in England. The reason Reform UK are making a fuss about it is because they are not confident that they'll be in such a good place this time next year.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. So Reform are basically saying with those polls, with the local elections, it's a dictatorship. Yeah. At the same time, they love Donald Trump, who's literally talked about ethnic cleansing. And did you see Farage talk about that?
Yes.
About the ethnic cleansing of God?
Well, and he managed great to make it even more despicable, really, didn't he? Because he said, oh, it'd be brilliant to have casinos and everything. And he'll have done that deliberately, knowing full well that the way to really add insult to injury is to displace a largely Muslim population and install something that Islam is not particularly happy about.
Yeah. So there's that. And I think it's just continual gaffes. I think Farage will make more gaffes the longer he's around. And that's why...
He doesn't like questions.
He doesn't, no. But that brings up the fact that, you know, Channel 4, BBC 4 actually held into account and pointed out he's got no policies. And then I thought, when you listen to Zia Youssef talk about it as well, and you were like, you just said in the first 30 days you're going to change everything, but you've not stated anything that you're going to change. And I'm just like, this is the type of stuff. If you keep pressing them on, they are going to gaff up. They just will. It's inevitable, because that's what history shows, that Farage does that, especially when a decent interviewer puts him to account. He gets ripped into, like the James O'Brien one from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
That was devastating to Farage.
I mean, the Radio 4 one, I didn't think was as good. Yes, they were not letting him get away with it, but they, it wasn't good because they weren't putting very, like, I mean, I argued if he's not going to answer your questions, then you should make statements and sort of force him to answer them. So, you know, there was lots of things you could have argued there. But I mean, the thing about not having policies, that's not going to hurt them in the slightest. You don't need policies if you don't expect to win.
No, thanks, sir.
No one needs to. Like, if you look, for example, you know, I was during the election campaign, I was reading all the manifestos and stuff, even Reform UK's contract. But even sort of the more established parties, and for example, you look at like the Brexit positions in each of them, and you looked at the Green Party, they just said we should rejoin the EU. But you looked at some of their policies around the EU, and they didn't explain how they were going to do any of them. Mm. And there was some like that on the other ones as well, because they don't need to. They just have to say, we would do this. And it's like, okay, so yeah, how would you do that? But they don't have to say, because they're not going to be positioned to do it.
But that's not exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying, so there's at least a direction there with the Greens. So they're going, at some point, we'll rejoin. And you're going, okay, at some point, when it's appropriate, but they don't give the mechanism how. When you press Farage and you listen to the chat, Azir, you are like, okay, you're just saying stuff that doesn't nail anything down. And the great thing I thought about the BBC4 interview was when she really tried to press him to nail down what that policy was, he started gibbering about the USA. And everyone, like, because you said the policies wouldn't make a difference. I think if he comes out with a pro-US policy and Trump is obviously now connected to that, it might as well be one and the same thing. You've also got what you brought up earlier with the NHS. And the NHS stuff is going to hurt them because everyone can pile in on that and go, they want to privatise the NHS. Yeah. Here's a load of evidence and them wanting to privatise the NHS. So I think sometimes it doesn't... It's going to put him in a position, if he doesn't put out a policy that clearly states what he wants to do with the NHS, and it'll go against what he actually wants to do, which is to privatise it, versus the reality, which is the public want it as is, but better.
Yeah.
That could be a policy that damages him. And if he doesn't come out and stringently say what he wants to do, then we've got a problem. And the other thing is, if he did get into power, I think it's still unlikely at the moment, both because of gas and I don't trust his polls. And the polls aren't showing a big enough number for him to actually win enough seats to be able to get over the line. It doesn't show that, you know, the first past and post protection. I'm still thinking to myself, I think the policies will damage him because he's being vague. And when it comes to the election, he'll get pressed on it and he'll either have to backtrack on what he wants or he'll have to admit the truth and he's screwed.
Well,
I think you're very misplaced in looking at this because you're looking at it from your own perspective. You've got to look at it. Everybody's brain is wired slightly differently. Left-wing brains are wired differently to right-wing brains. And they think about things more autocratically on the right. Now, I happen to be connected to a lot of farmers who do tend to be a little bit more like that. And I speak to them all of the time about these things. And they are attracted to the strength of a leader and a personality of a leader. They don't look at the detail. They haven't got time, to be fair. They don't look at the policies. They actually make a decision on who do I want to see in number 10? And it is a lot of it is about personality. And the reason that Farage is such a worry is that he's got the majority of the media absolutely 100% behind him.
But it's not 100%. I think that's unfair. I've had
farmers telling me that we should have him, you know, that he's going to be on, like, they believe he's going to be our next prime minister. I'm concerned about that because, you know, when Jo Swinson said she could be the prime minister, she ended up being attacked by the media, if you remember. But everybody, the media is raising this thing of he could be. And let's be fair. Even if there was an election tomorrow, there would be a coalition between the Tories coalition between the Tories and Reform. And that's exactly how Hitler came to power. It's the same thing. But I think to get across this, and it's exactly the lesson that wasn't learned from the left with Brexit, is that it's not about detail. It's about feelings and a feeling of, I want this person because they're saying something. And some of them are attracted to that feeling of they're putting Britain or America first. And that's uncomfortable for those of us on the left, but we've got to try and understand the messaging around that to make it attractive. My own view is if I was running the Labour Party, I would say, for Christ's sake, Starmer's far too technocratic. He hasn't got any personality. You need to get a new leader in before, you know, before the next election. Somebody like Andy Burnham, who has got the ability to speak well. Because it doesn't matter about...
Wait. Liz, finish your point.
Sorry.
And then
but
Phil.
It isn't about whether... It's not about what you think from your place. It is just, and I'm saying as an example, David Miliband would be better. You know, that's got more of a personality. Ultimately, a leader of a party can only lead so much because all of the cabinet has got to agree. It's like whenever you lead a group of anything, the only difference with Reform is that Nigel can do what he wants because he's got a limited company now. And he's tried the democratic system. He said, bugger that, I'm going to do a dictatorship. And of course, it's a lot easier if you run it as a dictatorship. I mean, because you can turn around and if someone disagrees, you say, OK, off you go. This is my kit. This is my outfit. Off you go. And the Labour Party and the Conservative Party don't have that luxury. And that's why I feel that at the moment there isn't the right strategy to deal with Farage. And I see the Labour Party mirroring the Reform Party in some form of soft way, thinking that they're going to get support by saying what Reform and the Conservatives have said. And it's really, really frustrating because I don't think it's the right message. People want to feel hope and aspirational, that mm-hmm. we're, you know, there is hope for the future. And that just isn't there. The only person offering any kind of, it's fine, I'm going to sort it all out, is Nigel.
Yes, Starmer hasn't got the personality, hasn't got the charisma. It's a huge failing. But the ones who do, and Andy Burnham absolutely doesn't. He made no impression when he stood for leader before. He's also, you know, he's like doing a really good job in Manchester. Leave him there because he's a bit of a snake. He will divide people like you would not believe. The Labour Party will have a civil war if he even tried to come back. When Ed and David Miliband were vying for election for the Labour leadership a long time ago now, I wasn't in Labour at the time, but my view, because ironically I'd quit Labour over the Iraq War and then came back a bit later, or a lot later actually, but I still supported Labour. I still voted for Labour. And my view is I was glad that Ed Miliband was made leader because David Miliband had a sort of used car salesman smarminess to him. And I thought Ed Miliband was much more genuine, which I still do. But what, and this is a mistake I never intend to make again. So I basically, I sort of also thought David Miliband would be more palatable to the public, but I thought Ed Miliband would be engaging enough and I was wrong. So what I did is I sacrificed what I thought, you know, was some electability, thinking I could afford it, even though it wasn't my decision and it wouldn't have swung it anyway. But nonetheless, I still supported it. And that was a mistake because David Miliband might have won that next election.
Do you think he would have done it?
I haven't got a crystal ball, but no. What I would say is Ed Miliband, I mean, I think he went wrong in his stance on austerity, and that caused all sorts of problems for Labour at the time and in the future as well. But just there was no coherency there. So not only was he not engaging enough, he just made no impression. But you'll say the same about Starmer. But unlike Starmer, he just had no focus. There was no focus. There was nothing there. There was no plan. It was all just a bit like the Tories now. It's all just reacting to stuff. Mm. I didn't see a coherent plan. And then during the election, when you had the Ed Stone brought out, just thought, yeah, that's that gone.
I mean, I mean, I can't say too much about Ed and the difference between Ed and David Miliband. I think Ed Miliband has matured a little bit more humour, a little bit more savvy with how everything works.
Yes.
I've noticed he's chilled out a little bit, which is probably what he needed. And being so young at the time, maybe it was a bit too much. I've got to take. You mentioned that the pollster was out of uni and had a PhD, and checked the analysis and everything. There have been plenty of examples in history of young 20-year-olds just taking over the world. There is potential.
Yes,
I don't like the youth thing being brought up and being.
It's
like,
not. It's not the fact that he's young. It was the fact that the poll was incompetently managed.
Because that's
the first bit I did. And I looked at it and it was so bad when I looked at the details and the raw data and the way the questions were done. It was so incompetent. I thought, I need to know who did this. And it took me a long time. And then I found, oh, yeah, someone straight out of university having done a history degree, Where, yes, historians can learn to be, but, yes, but are you a pollster?
The issue, like,
yes, some historians can become pollsters, of course they
the
can.
The issue we've got is that with the cameras in Parliament, which came in back in the 80s, I think, under Thatcher,
that
it had gone more into personality populism around leaders and politicians. And it's more like reality TV now. Who's going to win? I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And that's really what the issue is. It's not good, it's really bad, because it doesn't matter what they are, as long as they look right and the media like them, they can sell them. And that is how we ended up with Boris Johnson. The world that we live in.
It's not. You've got to also think about the counter to that. We also end up with Boris Johnson because Labour did not put up against him an alternative that the public would find palatable. One thing or the other, it's like you were saying, Liz, and you're quite right. People think, it's not just farmers, it's not just people on the right. A lot of people treat a general election as a presidential election, and they're choosing largely between two leaders. And that is very noticeable amongst those swing voters. But, you know, Boris Johnson was never popular. I mean, I know Keir Starmer's not popular, but he was never popular. But he was more popular than his alternative. So if Labour had have had someone more popular, then Boris Johnson would not have won.
Well, if it being, no, it wasn't Corbyn, was it? No.
Corbyn at the time, he was not palatable to the public.
But Corbyn had better results than Starmer, which is also an amazing kicker that never gets
he had better results. He lost twice.
No, he had better numbers. He had better. He got more votes than Starmer, didn't he? I'm not saying he got more MPs.
He did that by building up his support in the cities and things. That's not how you win. You can't.
No, it's not the only
way.
That's
not how you win.
That is a
you
key
have to win. You have to focus on who you have to win a lot of seats by very small margins, which is what they did. But it's also what Boris Johnson did. He didn't win. Like, he wasn't winning massive majorities. There were tiny majorities in a lot of cases. In 2017, where, okay, technically Theresa May didn't win a majority, but she actually lost a majority, that came down to about 9,000 votes. If you could have picked 9,000 extra votes for Labour in just a few places, all of a sudden Labour would be the minority government. It came down to literally a few thousand votes, but that is still what it came down to. It's all right, say, oh, you got much closer, you got more votes. Doesn't matter, votes is irrelevant, utterly irrelevant. Trump, at the last election, not the one just gone, but the one before, 2020, he won the second most number of votes of any presidential candidate in history. But the one who won the most was Biden the same year, and that's what counted.
And the extra 6 million. Well, so two things to that. There's the strong personality. I think Mike Nanas, who we had on the show, who used to be an advisor to Kamala Harris, said it was down. He said the stats had shown that it came down to three states and 200,000 to 108,000 votes in those three states. And if it swung the other way, which it could have done if a number of other things had happened, Kamala Harris would have been in it. Yeah. That says to me, it's very similar to that proportional to the first past the post system, because you get electoral college votes. I'll say this. I don't. So, Liz, when you said potentially we don't get that right wing view, I will push back and say I think I do. I've been around enough of those people, enough of those areas to recognise that. But also through history, I've looked at those strong personality types that come to the forefront, and especially using modern media. So we could say Mussolini and Adolf Hitler both used modern media in which to take power. So that's using radio, which came about, that's using TV, that's using cinema. And one of the things I found with both of them, one of the things that they had as a strong component for being looked as a strong personality was their military record, and also Mussolini especially, being the strong man. He always used to do these photo ops, like topless, and he was quite ripped, even at his, right, I think he was 40 when he took power. Maybe younger, I'll have to check that. I don't see that with Nigel. I don't see that strong personality type. I actually see
the metropolitan view, the London view, and not the rural view. Because one of our young farmers, Ollie, who's, you know, Fletcher, who's got Farming Explained, historian, he's a Labour Party member, and he lives in Leicestershire. And he said that a lot of his contemporaries are swinging behind Nigel. And the reason being is because he's on TikTok and they just see this personality. And as you say, he's using that. And Starmer is very rigid, boring, and also they're disappointed by the budget and the Winter Fury. You know, the attacks are intense. I mean, he didn't want to go near Brexit, and yet he's gone near... He's done the Winter Fuel Alliance, and the budget is cataclysmic for business and all of these things. None of it is good. And so people are looking for an alternative. They don't see it in the Conservatives.
That's different.
And so they're attracted to Nigel. Well, the Conservatives need to get a new leader in, and I'm sure they will, because they are,
won't be any better,
you know, they know the art of survival. But ultimately, where we are at the moment is this is what's going on. We don't even know, you know, what will be happening. But what is happening is that a belief is forming that Nigel Farage could be our next prime minister. And that is extraordinary.
But there's a difference between a strong personality type and just going for a different option. And I think you're right. I think the media has been 100% galvanizing towards him, probably because of ratings. And because of sales. So if it's newspaper journalism, they probably think they'll get more sales from that than, for example, Ed Davey or the leader of the Green Party. And so therefore, you've got this model that's more interested in making money than it is on the policies or anything else. And Nigel this week, on this morning, came out and thanked ITV for helping him gain in the rankings because he went to I'm a Celebrity Australia. And that boosted him, he claims, I think, on both TikTok and social media in general. Which is fucking wild. And you're right, Starmer is weak on social media. I think there's a difference between him being a strong personality and that of they're just desperate for any alternative and he seems to be the only one vying on the right. I think there's even an issue. I mean, you brought up Kemi Badenoch. She's a weak leader. There's no arguing about it. She doesn't know how to do media. She doesn't know how to what to say. She doesn't know decent catchphrases. She doesn't know how to galvanise the population. Doesn't know how to galvanise. Yeah, and she's lost hand over fist money. So I think it's more down to the weakness than it is about Nigel. And I think Starmer's weak, and I think Kemi's weak, and Ed Davey and the Greens have to sort their comms out as much as anyone else. Because Nigel is leading it. But I mean, it doesn't help with the media. I think there's that's why I've got that nuance of it being not necessarily about his strong personality. It's possibly the weakness of the opposition, either with their personalities or with their comms.
But two things I would say on that. So Liz saying about that person saying, oh, this budget's really bad for business. So that's a perception which is not at all backed up. When I read like the serious financial articles and papers, they all think that Reeves's budget is very good for business and very good for the economy. The Financial Times are constantly saying so. They regularly reflect on people's perceptions to it. But businesses and the Economist and like Forbes and Financial Times and all the rest of it are all saying these are really good moves, which means that Labour are confident that come the... Because remember, there is no election now. The polling at the moment is utterly irrelevant for all sorts of reasons. It's not generating great headlines, but people will completely forget about it if they have their minds changed in a few years' time. And all the indicators are that the economy is not, it's never going to be firing all cylinders, but that doesn't matter. No. As Starmer has said, the most important thing is do individual people believe it's working more in their favour? And according to all of the expert articles I read, the answer is yes, they think it will. But the second thing about social media, which...
Can I just interject quickly there?
Yeah.
Just to give you an example, the country's largest raspberry grower employs, I don't know how many people, a lot. His wages bill is in excess of £30 million a year. His wages bill has gone up by £4.2 million this year. And so the national insurance rise is a major problem on SMEs. And whilst big business, big corporations might be happy with distressing smaller business so they can go in and hoover them up, that might be the case. But certainly the mixture of getting rid of APR, BPR and the national insurance rise is toxic to SMEs.
If they're employing lots of people, they're not an SME. And although there will be some who get caught in the middle...
Well, because it's a family business, it's still, it's still run as a family business.
No, it wouldn't be defined. I don't think that would be the definition of an SME.
No, it's defined by how many employees they have. And really small business, never mind just SMEs, but really small businesses actually gained extra tax breaks from the national insurance as well. So in terms of raw numbers, you may know there are always in any tax change system, and Reeves had to do something. She needed that big pot, that huge sum of money.
She could have gone after the LLPs.
LLPs, or limited liability partnerships, are a type of business structure that combines elements of a partnership and a limited company. They are commonly used by professional service firms, such as law firms, accountancies and consultancies, but can be used by other businesses as well.
And their loophole, which actually cost the taxpayer billions.
Wouldn't have generated as much. There are things she should have done as well, but that wouldn't have generated anywhere near as much.
Also, getting rid of the subsidy to the North American landowners for Drax Power. That's half a billion a year for them to chop down trees and ship them over here and burn in Drax Power. Because that money is going out of our country. And then they're expecting our farms and small businesses to plug this supposed black hole.
It's a real black hole. That was confirmed.
But,
the OBR wrote a report saying it's real.
Yeah, the OBR.
The budget is a big offensive on small and medium-sized businesses, apart from the tiny, tiny ones. But also, if you are a startup with just a few employees, you're not going to be motivated to actually go past that threshold now unless you're really going to bring in the money.
We got into the trap of, again, ignoring the fact that Brexit has cost us $40 billion in tax, which if we had, we wouldn't have had to put that tax on. So therefore, we wouldn't have the national insurance.
Yeah, but nothing could change that in the here and now. Even if Labour had been able to say we want to join the EU immediately, that wouldn't have changed it for 10 years.
I would have said, I agree with that. It would probably take 10 years for us to go in once we said that.
I've got one point, Liz,
and then I'll stop.
Go on, then.
Over to you. It would have increased the pound, which means imports are cheaper. That's an instant effect. That would happen. Go ahead, Liz.
I think if you look back to the last parliament, when the Tories were in power, and they actually kept moving their manifesto by changing the bloody leader.
They lost the election.
If you want to hold on to power, get a new leader in, like, you know, they changed to trust initially, get a new leader in who suddenly goes through, they go through it with a new manifesto, go, I'm going to take over and this is what I'm going
to
do.
You're just saying that the Labour should do what the Tories did to lose the election. You say they changed their leader and broke their manifesto. They lost the election,
not because they changed leader. They lost the election because Truss crashed the economy. If Labour put somebody in who actually fixes Brexit... they would actually get rid of all of the problems
Honestly, that is against all of the absolute data. But also, they didn't lose the election because they changed leader, but they did lose the election because they broke their manifesto promises. They promised the new hospitals. That was a big part. Also, you're saying this as if the Tories were on course to win the election before they got Truss in. No, that's why they got Truss in, because they were not on course to win the election.
The Labour government has nosedived. I think it's the most historic drop.
No, it's not. It's the same as happened to Thatcher. And she won another three elections. Well, she won another two elections. And then So there was polling on this. And obviously that boosted her appeal. But it was determined that didn't actually factor into it. What factored into it was the fact that Labour presented a much worse alternative, because that's what it comes down to. You know, the reputed longest suicide note in history.
Oh, yes. I remember that, 1983, yes.
And then she went on. Thatcher brought us two recessions and still won. And, you know, what was it? Three elections on the bounce.
I think it's about the personality, but she also had the support of Murdoch, didn't she?
So there was the thing about, you were saying about social media. So, because this is my hobby horse, because you are quite right. So at the moment, I look at these things a lot. Nigel Farage is the only political leader in this country, out of everyone, literally every single party in the country, who takes social media seriously. Yeah. He gets a decent number of views across all platforms, and no one else's. And I particularly focus on YouTube because I'm on YouTube. But for example, so you look at everyone, like Labour's, the Lib Dems, the Green Party, the SNP, the Conservatives, they're all crap. They're nothing. I could start a new channel and be doing getting better views than them in like 2 weeks. And you could think to yourself, well, maybe they just don't appreciate the importance. But Keir Starmer created a YouTube channel that's called Keir Starmer. So he must think that YouTube, he must recognise that YouTube has potential voters on it, and yet it's pants. And it, yep. And the reason is, and it chimes in a bit with what Liz has been saying, because it's all like there was this, so YouTube recently did a massive study on what engages people on YouTube. It's really fascinating read. And they didn't just survey people, they did brain scans and everything. So they really found out what turns people on. And the massive thing that came out of it was like, I can't remember the word they use, but like credibility or being genuine. And you look at the stuff that Labour put out, and it's the same with all of the rest of them. And it's all corporate bullshit. It's the stuff you go to a conference and look at this thing on there and the slow motion bollocks and all the rest of it. And it like, and stood just, you know, like that, two flags in the background. And it's all this corporate bollocks that doesn't, it looks contrived. And it, you know, their content is rubbish. The way they present their content is rubbish. Like literally every way that whoever manages that Keir Starmer website or YouTube channel, literally, and I don't want to like attack people who are just doing a job, but literally everything they're doing is wrong. I cannot think of anything on it that is good. But just even just something as simple as that presentation, because it is contrived and it looks contrived and it shouldn't, and they can easily come up with something that it's, looks you know, more...
It's an absolute crying shame, because he did really well in the riots in the summer and he had the right message. He was in control and... It was absolutely right. And then it just all fell apart with the, you know, the freebies and then the winter fuel allowance, the VAT on school fees, and then the budget. I think he's cooked his goose. And I think the only way that Labour will win power in the next election is by finding a new leader. Whoever that is, I don't know, but they need to get a new leader.
If they get a new leader, they will definitely lose, and they will definitely not lose. Then they won't get a new leader, because why would they? That makes no sense. At the moment, you are looking at polling that is just, and every pollster says this, even the godfather himself, Curtis, says this. The polling right now is a pure consequence of the fact that Conservatives have, in your words, cooked their goose, and there's nothing they can do about it now. I mean, yes, they will replace Bannock. She's truly awful. The next one. At the moment, the default choice is Cleverly or Jenrick. They're not going to be any better. Cleverly might be a bit better, but they've got no agency anymore. They have zero agency to show people that they can do better now. And they haven't got the money to do that detailed polling to find out who their votes are and all the rest of all the stuff that Labour can do. But but Labour have agency. They are going to make people feel better off. So all of this polling right now is just going to go away in a few years' time. Now, I would be happier if they were leaning into more than simply delivering, because they need people to not only feel better off, but to realise it's as a result of government actions, because the media will say, no, it's just actually... Oh, actually, it was stuff the Tories did. It was just like a seed that had to grow. But nonetheless... The polling as it is now is not going to be how it's going to be in 3 years' time. I wish I could say in 1 year time, but I also know it's going to take longer than that, because the Labour are putting a lot of their hopes on their planning reforms and energy, boosting energy infrastructure. And the legislation is still passing through Parliament. Once it's passed through Parliament, then it's still going to take time before the spade's in the ground type of thing. So you are probably talking 3 years, although I don't think it's like 3 years cork out of the bottle. But I think this year is going to be really horrific polling wise. But after that, it's not. It's going to be getting next election.
So one of the things I've noticed, and I've been asked, I always go around and ask all the guys in my area who sell fruit and veg, and they're now saying they're getting change, loose change, like someone's gone behind the sofa to dig out money to pay for, you know, a bowl of fruit or veg for a quid. Now, the reason I bring that up is I quite like Gary Stevenson's analogy of the economy. As much as it's good to listen sometimes to the Financial Times and Bloomberg and the stats, he felt when he was a stockbroker, it was better to go out and just ask people, how is the economy doing for them right now? And when I hear stuff like there's a good chance people are digging behind the sofa to get out cash just to pay for food, and we know that a third of the population have 0 to 250 quid in savings, I'm going, I'm still not, my prediction is no, I don't think the economy is going to get better. And especially, as we've been talking about him so much, Donald Trump is in charge, because the crap that he comes out with puts up, the thing about Brexit was, when we're in the EU, we're more secure. We're part of a group that can defend themselves. When you're out on your own like that, we're literally a tea bag in the ocean currents. And whatever happens globally affects us more as a result of being out, which is not being taught by the media. So I'm going to throw out a true or false. Do you think what was worse for polling, getting back into the EU, rejoining, and therefore dissatisfaction with Brexit, or getting out of the Vietnam War? Which one got more disapproval quicker, Vietnam War or Brexit? Liz?
Oh my God. I'm going to go with my heart. I'm going to say Brexit.
Is worse off than the Vietnam War. Phil?
Were we in the Vietnam War? I don't think we were in the Vietnam War.
No, I'm saying Americans hated the Vietnam War or disapproved of it as much as people disapprove of Brexit, according to polling. Whether or not you want to debate about the polling, that's fine. But according to the polls.
Which one became more unpopular quicker?
I would say the Vietnam War then, because that was seen as a national defeat, surely.
Initially, Brexit was more unpopular in that 9-year period. Pretty much, Brexit is as unpopular as the Vietnam War was to Americans. Americans hated the Vietnam War as much as Brits hate Brexit, which is, to me, quite a shocking stat. And that Brits disliked it as much. Now, you know, read into that as you will about that polling, but I was quite taken back when I looked at the dissatisfaction of both. How is Brexit as unpopular and has been more unpopular than the Vietnam War? That blows my mind. So on that note, Liz, co-host, thank you very much for coming on. Phil, thank you so much for being a guest and coming in and somewhat rescuing us. What a robust debate. If you got this far in the video, please hit that like and subscribe button. Thank you once again to everyone. Bye for now. Hail the lamp.
Hail the lamp.
As Valentine's Day is coming up, I'm going to give you three choices for love, marry, send to Mars. Okay? Keir Starmer, Andy Burnham, Angela Rayner.
You have to define this. What am I supposed to do here? I'm already married.
You've got three options.
Bigamy is illegal.
Marry, send to Mars. And you've got Starmer.
Give me three people I'm reasonably happy with.
I know. That's why I've asked it. Because it's a bad choice between the three.
I've got to have to send Andy Burnham to Mars because there's someone else. I mean, he's doing a good job in Manchester. I don't really feel like it, but the other two are doing a better job nationally.
So love Starmer and marry Angela Rayner or vice versa?
My wife wouldn't be happy at either prospect, but is this love and marry, is this like, so am I going to have not only a bigamous relationship, but I'm also going to have an infidelity as well. Have I got to marry one of them, but actually be in love with the other?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll have to marry Rayner and be in love with Starmer then. it's your choice. I mean, I've just put them in priority order. This is your scenario.
It is. Liz, it is my scenario. It's a devilish scenario. I agree. Liz, Starmer, Obama, Trudeau. Love, marry, send to Mars.
Okay. I would marry Obama if I was single.
If he wasn't.
Trudeau.
Who have I got? Obama, Trudeau, and
Starmer.
Starmer's definitely going to Mars. And I love Trudeau. Easy.
Well, that was an easy one, wasn't it? Friends dinner. So you've got all your friends round. Unfortunately, one of these two people are coming to the dinner, whether you like it or not. Liz, Priti Patel or Piers Corbyn, and they're going to be with you all night with your friends. Who do you pick?
Oh, Piers Corbyn, for sure. Yeah.
How come?
He's funny. Why?
All the conspiracy theories that he'll be spouting all night. Like, he literally takes over Hustings. I've witnessed it. He just grabs the mic and then just starts ranting. So you would have to put up with that. I guess it's better than listening to Priti Patel try and justify ethnic of Gaza.
100%. Yeah.
Okay, Bill, your two choices for your friend's dinner party. Prince Andrew or Piers Morgan?
I might cause a diplomatic row if I invited Prince Andrew. We'll have Piers Morgan because he would leave. Actually, I wouldn't have to put up with him all night because he would leave.
You'd wind him up?
In a strop, I would wind him up.